This show is a Hopful Media podcast production.
It's time to bust out the tongs and enjoy USDA certified tender steaks, juicy burgers, and more from Omaha Steaks. And you can get 50% off site-wide at omahasteaks.com. Plus, you get an extra $35 off with promo code YUM at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details. There's nothing like firing up that grill for the first cookout of the summer. And with so many protein options, you're bound to be able to make something for anybody. What better way to honor the Memorial Day holiday than with a meal from America's original butcher? Every entree is flash frozen, vacuum sealed, and ready for when you want to grill. Omaha Steaks removes the guesswork by delivering expert crafted beef with guaranteed quality and consistency. Start your summer off right with Omaha Steaks. Visit omahasteaks.com right now for 50% off site-wide during the Memorial Day sale. And for an extra $35 off, use promo code YUM at checkout. That's omahasteaks.com with promo code YUM at checkout. Terms apply. See site for details.
Hey, History of Persia fans. Before Persia, another civilization controlled the Middle East. The very first civilization, the inventors of writing itself. From the clay tablets of ancient Mesopotamia come the oldest stories. The history and myth of the first Mesopotamians is the subject of the Oldest Stories podcast online at oldeststories.net. If you like ancient history, come check out the Oldest Stories after you listen to this episode.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the History of Persia. I'm Trevor Cully, and this is episode 163, The Upper Satrapies. Well, I certainly picked a hell of a time to automate some episode drops, pack up, move halfway across the US, and lose some of my recording equipment in a box for a month. Look, for posterity's sake, we are in early April 2026 when I'm recording this, and I will have a full response to the news in the next couple of days. But if you've been following me for 6 years, you can probably at least ballpark most of my opinions on the horrors we have wrought upon the world anyway. It took way too long to get up and running again, and for that, I apologize. Before jumping into the full episode, I want to give you all a roadmap for the immediate future. For better or worse, I am back to podcasting more or less full-time from today and for the foreseeable future. So you can expect the rest of Antiochus III's story, America Secret Wars Season 2, and a fundraising update over the next couple of weeks. Most of that sooner rather than later. Oh, and the actual 2026 holiday special. I've marked my calendar, Tiragon is not slipping past me again. Last time, we covered the turbulent start of Antiochus III's reign over the Seleucid Empire, and when we left off, it looked a lot like the Seleucids were on the verge of collapse. Antiochus came to power after both his father and his elder brother died in quick succession. He was faced with conflict on all sides immediately. His brother, Seleucus III Kerenaus, was assassinated while trying to reconquer Anatolia from King Attalus of Pergamon. Molon, the satrap of Media and lord of the Upper Satrapies, rebelled, taking most of the Eastern Empire with him, and proceeded to expand westward, seizing control of much of Mesopotamia after defeating two loyalist armies. The ruthless Prime Minister Hermaeus convinced Antiochus not to give either situation his full attention, despite the advice of other counselors like General Epigenes. Instead, Antiochus and Hermaeus went to launch an invasion of Ptolemaic territory in Coel, Syria, only to be repelled by the fortresses guarding Mount Lebanon. When we left off, Antiochus had been convinced to march against Molon in person, and Hermaeus was acting as if he had thought that was a great idea the entire time. They spent the winter of 221 to 220 BCE in Nisibis, and Achaeus continued the war against Attalus in the north. Achaeus was extremely successful, pushing the kingdom of Pergamon back to its antebellum borders, and all of this chaos prompted Achaeus to declare himself king, initially attempting to march on Antioch before a mutiny in his own ranks convinced him to settle for carving out a little kingdom in Anatolia. Today, we will follow Antiochus III into the east as he faces down Molon, who never openly declared himself king, but for all intents and purposes, ruled over a kingdom that included most of modern Iran and Iraq. They set out from Nisibis in the spring of 220, and Polybios describes some debate between Hermaeus and Zeuxis, the general who oversaw the loyalist evacuation from Babylonia, about which route they should take on their march. I'd go into more detail, but frankly, I find it hard to follow what Polybius is trying to convey, because his understanding of the region's geography isn't all that reliable. For example, he says that the army of Antiochus crossed the Tigris River in three places to stop in Apollonia, which we are pretty sure was the district surrounding Arbela in northeastern Mesopotamia, and then marched on Dura Europus, which is at the far southwestern corner of the region. What seems more likely is that the army split into three separate groups, each with their own objectives. One of those armies got resupplied and reinforced in Apollonia, while another went to end Molon's siege at Dura. This allowed the main army east of the Tigris to circumvent the royal canal that connected both rivers, and block Molon's supply lines in the Diala River Valley, which connected Babylonia to Media. When Antiochus started marching toward the Tigris, Molon's army in Babylon raced north to intercept, but they were not fast enough, and Antiochus entered Apollonia with Molon still in the south. Light infantry scouts sent by both armies encountered one another on the road in a brief skirmish before retreating to their respective hosts and making camp. The two armies encamped less than 8 kilometers away from one another, and Molon attempted another sneak attack by night, which had been a successful tactic for him before. But 10 men from his army deserted mid-march, and he assumed that they had gone over to warn Antiochus. So Molon was first to return to his camp and prepare for a field battle in the morning. They met along the banks of the Diala River, in the midst of the Hamrin Mountains, an area that was particularly poorly suited to standard Hellenistic tactics. But they could compensate by ensuring that as much of the cavalry as possible was concentrated on the flanks, where the terrain was a little flatter to allow the horsemen to maneuver. So from right to left, Antiochus assigned his heavy cavalry, then Cretan, Gallic, and Greek mercenaries, then the main phalanx of domestic recruits, and finally his personal hetairoi, the elite royal cavalry unit of the Macedonian armies. By this time, Hellenistic armies made use of elephants as a standard tactic. But the Seleucid elephant corps had only recently been captured by Ptolemy III, so Antiochus was only able to deploy about 10 of the great beasts in front of his battle line. Hermaeus and Zeuxis shared command of the left wing, the king's hetairoi, meaning they shared the most politically prestigious position, while Antiochus actually took charge of the right wing himself. Molon's forces, still tired from a failed night attack and the chaotic return of the soldiers, had trouble getting into position. But ultimately, their setup mirrored the loyalist army, with cavalry on the wings and infantry in the center. Molon positioned himself on the right, directly across from Hermaeus and Zeuxis, leaving one of his younger brothers, Neolaus, across from Antiochus. Molon's army also reflected the Iranian military traditions of his territory, with a row of scythed chariots rather than elephants screening the infantry, and cohorts of archers and slingers set back behind the cavalry, ready to step forward and loose deadly rain on the loyalist center once the horses charged out. Like many Hellenistic battles since the arrival of Alexander the Great, the available sources, in this case just Polybius, only describe the sections of the army with famous commanders. So we don't hear much about what happened between the infantry, the elephants, and the chariots. The cavalry on both sides charged, and Molon's wing locked into fierce combat with Zeuxis. Neolaus had much worse luck. According to Polybius, the rebel cavalry saw that Antiochus had suddenly surrendered. And went over to the king as soon as they knew he was in the field. This is presented as the lowly horseman being awed by the royal presence. But the more likely explanation is that the presence of the king gave the impression that the opposing cavalry must be an especially strong force, disheartening the rebels. Regardless, when they started to see their counterparts on the far side of the field collapse, Molon's wing began to waver. And likewise, his infantry seems to have given way and started a retreat at this point, because Molon's cavalry were soon surrounded by loyalist forces. Fearing the brutal torture and inevitable crucifixion that awaited a rebel of his caliber, Molon took his own life rather than be captured. Neolaus fled the battlefield with his own personal companions to their other brother, Alexander the Satrap of Persis, not to continue the fight, but to execute a worst-case scenario plan. Neolaus convinced Alexander that further resistance was futile, now that Molon was dead, and their best soldiers were all executed, killed, or captured. So Neolaus killed his own mother, his own wife, and their children, his nieces and nephews, i.e. Molon's children, and then the two remaining rebel brothers, Neolaus and Alexander, also took their own lives. Given the mass murder-suicide by Neolaus, we can probably guess that Alexander also killed his own family, if he had one. Most of Molon's army was pardoned, with the exception of some nobles and officers set to be executed for treason. The remainder was assigned new loyalist officers and ordered to march back to their homes in Iran. Of course, to get there, they would have to march by Molon's corpse, which had been recovered and crucified at the mouth of a mountain pass between the Zagros and Mesopotamia. Antiochus then went to Seleucia on the Tigris to reestablish royal authority over the rebel provinces. As a key royal city that had quietly surrendered rather than defend itself, Seleucia was due for punishment. But Antiochus did not oversee this himself, leaving the gruesome task to Hermaeus. Hermaeus executed and tortured many of the city's inhabitants who had collaborated with the rebellion. and he exiled the city magistrates who had nominally remained loyal, but surrendered. He also imposed a 1,000 silver talent fine on the city as a form of collective financial punishment. This went on for a while before Antiochus intervened personally. Apparently uncomfortable with both Hermaeus's rampant brutality and the fact that it was doing more to create unrest in Seleucia than Molon ever had, the purge came to an end and the fine was reduced to just 150 talents. That is still an unholy quantity of precious metal, but nothing compared to the generational debt that Hermaeus intended to impose. This also seems like the moment when an odd incident mentioned by Pliny the Elder in his Natural History took place. He references a Seleucid governor on the Persian Gulf coast winning a battle against the Persians. Pliny only mentions that the king at the time was Antiochus, but not which one. Antiochus III's reconquest of the region, or the brief revolt back in the time of Antiochus I Soter, are the most likely candidates. The deaths of Molon, Alexander, and apparently several loyalist satraps in the recent conflict necessitated a change in management for the Seleucid East. Diogenes, the satrap of Elam, was relieved from the siege of Susa when Molon was defeated and given a promotion to satrap of Media. A noble called Apollodorus took his place in Susiana, and Carmana went to Tychon, another noble from Antiochus's inner circle. Polybios doesn't mention it, but presumably Babylonia needed a new governor as well, since the last one had been killed by Molon. However, the war in the east wasn't quite finished. Molon had received support from his independent neighbors, namely King Artabarzanes of Media Atropatene. The northwestern part of Achaemenid Media, which largely overlaps with modern Azerbaijan. Occasionally, you will see articles that describe Artabarzanes as some sort of Armenian dynast, but that largely seems to be a misunderstanding of ancient geographic terminology. Even though he doesn't say it explicitly, likely because he did not know the name, Polybius very clearly described the geography of Atropatene, and we know the king of Armenia at the time was not named Artabarzanes. Atropatene had apparently provided funds and mercenaries to Molon. Antiochus marched up into the northern Zagros Mountains to make an example, defeating Artabarzanes and apparently subjugating Atropatene properly for the first time since Alexander the Great first declared it a separate province. Artabarzanes was not deposed, but forced to become a tribute-paying vassal of King Antiochus. Now I want to do something a bit different. Hermaeus is still angling for power behind the scenes, and Polybius, or more accurately, his original Hellenistic source, even accused the prime minister of encouraging Antiochus to invade Atropatene in hopes that the king would die in battle, granting Hermaeus a lengthy regency over Antiochus's infant son, another Antiochus, who was born shortly after Molon's defeat. However, if Hermaeus wanted the king dead, he had ample opportunity to orchestrate that himself. He seems to have been content as a vizier, and Antiochus had grown at this point to recognize when Hermaeus's advice was faulty, and how to recognize sound advice from Zeuxis and other members of the Royal Advisory Council. His success over Molon sounded like the beginning of a successful reign, though just how long that would last was anybody's guess in 220 BCE. Instead of continuing the narrative as Antiochus shifted focus to another theater of his many ongoing conflicts, I want to spend the rest of this episode with the beginning of a new Grand Tour series, exploring the inner workings and local developments of each province as Antiochus encountered them. Today, we are starting with the Upper Satrapies, the Seleucid name for basically everything east of the Zagros Mountains. During Antiochus's war with Molon, the extent of these satrapies had been greatly reduced, with the new Arsacid dynasty now ruling Parthia, but more importantly, Diodotus II ruling as an independent king in Bactria, Sogdiana, and Margiana, who had apparently begun the process of annexing more Seleucid territory into his realm, specifically the old Achaemenid satrapies of Aria and Drangiana in central and eastern Iran. We will be dealing with the Parthian and Greco-Bactrian kingdoms another day, so for now, we start with Media. After the fall of the Achaemenid dynasty, the early Diadochoi were hesitant to invest much importance into the province of Persis, but they still needed a base of operations and control in the east. Media evolved to assume this role. The satraps of Media seem to have been the leading rulers of the upper satrapies, especially after Bactria became more autonomous. In the wars of the Diadochoi, Media was repeatedly plundered, just like basically everywhere else in the remains of Alexander's empire, but the situation stabilized under Seleucus Nicator and Antiochus I Soter. Ecbatana, the ancient capital of the Medes, evolved once again to become the seat of imperial power in Iran. However, the Seleucids did not control the Eastern Caucasus. That fell to the independent kings of Atropatene. Likewise, Khwarazmia was now independent on the southern coast of the Aral Sea, and the Seleucids failed to control nearly as many of the steppe nomad tribes as the Achaemenids once had. As a result, much of the northeastern Seleucid Empire was now prone to nomadic invasions. This is what eventually gave rise to the Arsacids that have taken control of Parthia. Both to protect Media from these attacks, and to establish their own presence in Iran, the early Seleucids made northwestern Iran the focus of an extensive colonization campaign. Greek cities were established around the borders of the province, and the few existing urban centers like Ecbatana and Hragai were further developed as Hellenistic cities. Polybius even describes a temple to the Zoroastrian Yazada Anahita being built in Ecbatana and decorated with lavish gold and silver bricks, under the direction of Hellenistic rulers. Media was probably the most Hellenistic and urbanized region of Iran at this point, and remained as such for a very long time. Technically, I guess you could say that it's still true, given that between 3 and 5 of modern Iran's largest cities are in the area of ancient Media, depending on how you draw the border between the Seleucid province and Atropatene. Speaking of Atropatene, I should probably include it in our tour, since as of this episode, King Artabarzanes has submitted to the Seleucid rule. His capital was at the fortress of Gonzak, apparently built as a hub for regional taxation by the Achaemenids based on its etymology. Gonzak literally means treasury. And that's just about all we know. Atropatene was one of the most poorly documented and historically elusive Hellenistic kingdoms. Since most of northern and central Iran are currently out of Seleucid hands, and therefore outside the scope of this episode, we will jump to the south and cover the rest of the Iranian territory that Molon led in revolt, starting with the region I have been calling Karmana. Strictly speaking, that is the Achaemenid name for the area the Greeks knew as Karmania, and neither is used by Polybius while describing Seleucid political geography. He just calls the region now ruled by satrap Tycho as the Persian Gulf province. Given that Achaemenid Karmana is the only region that fits that description, not included in another province listed by Polybius, I'm going with the simpler title. That said, Karmana and Parsa were often lumped together by the Achaemenids, and the coast of Parsa, most notably the palace complex of Temukan, was apparently governed independently of Persepolis. So it's possible that the modern Bushehr and Hormazgan provinces were one unit, which I am calling Karmana, and the regions to their north were considered Persis under Seleucid rule. Frankly, we know just as little about Hellenistic Karmana as we do about Atropatene, despite its implicit importance as the region that controlled the Strait of Hormuz and trade between the imperial heartland, India, and Egypt. Geography and its importance doesn't change all that much over time. Strabo's geography references that the inland reaches of Karmana were also valuable gold mining territory, a resource that the Seleucid kings would doubtlessly want to control and place exceptionally loyal satraps in charge of, potentially explaining why the region did not initially side with Molon. I am going to skip over Persis for the moment, because our long overdue return to the Achaemenid homeland is actually one of the most interesting parts of this tour. Instead, I want to go to the region immediately west of Persis. Today, it's Khuzestan. The Achaemenids called it Huvja. I typically use its most famous ancient name, Elam. But the Seleucids had two intermingled names for this region. Susiana, of course derived from the local capital at Susa, and Elemais, clearly derived from the same root as Elam. Starting with Susa and its environs, the lowland region surrounding the Karka River, the once favored city of Darius the Great, was an unusual case in the Seleucid period. Right around our current point in the narrative, possibly in celebration of Molon's defeat, or one of Antiochus III's later triumphs, it was technically renamed as Seleucia on the Euliaos, using the Greek name for the local river. That name appears in a few official inscriptions and documents, but obviously it didn't stick, since today the city is called Shush. Despite the new name, Susa managed an odd blend of importance and neglect. There were important sanctuaries, especially to Nanaya, a syncretic goddess that blended elements of Zoroastrian Anahita, Babylonian Ishtar and Nanaya, and Elamite Pinnakir and Karirisha. All of these were goddesses on roughly the same spectrum of ancient belief as the Greek Aphrodite. There was a royal mint, which unusually produced large silver tetradrachma coins featuring Alexander the Great and Seleucus Nicator for almost a century, and a royal treasury until our current Antiochus restructured the city. Simultaneously, these locations are known almost exclusively through written records, and archaeology has struggled for over a century to find much evidence of the Seleucid administration at Susa. Nothing that looks like an official building has been identified, although a couple of Greek-style mansions have been located. It's possible, I suppose, that these little palaces served the official purposes, but their layout doesn't really support that. The old Achaemenid palace just seems to have been abandoned entirely, especially bizarre given that it was attached to the Acropolis of the city where Diogenes fortified himself to fight Molon, leaving a giant empty building directly adjacent to your most heavily fortified citadel is certainly an odd choice. The annex palace of Artaxerxes II was apparently outside the new city walls and occupied by squatters. There's a few pieces of Greek pottery and graffiti that have been found there, but nothing indicating official use. It's just particularly unusual that a city that supposedly housed both a satrap and a local strategos, an administrative general, would not use the existing palace complex. Instead, the Seleucids shifted more attention to the so-called royal town south of the palace, sparsely filled in Achaemenid times, but featuring several Seleucid inscriptions. One building, commonly called the Donjon by archaeologists, was located at the very southern edge of Old Susa. But despite early theories, this seems to have been the Temple of Nanaya, rather than an official palace based on the inscriptions located there. In general, much as in the Achaemenid period, there's plenty of evidence for people living in Susa during the Hellenistic Age, but minimal evidence of structures, and most of the structures found there have yet to be identified because they're fairly nondescript. One possible explanation for Susa in this period is the Iadana, a large temple or maybe a palace, which has been identified about 4 kilometers away, but not thoroughly investigated. If the Seleucid administration and settlement urbanization of the city was actually focused outside the area traditionally identified as Susa, it would not be that unusual. Ragai in Media, for example, has an archaeological record that appears to skip directly from the Neolithic to the 2nd century BCE, while we know that it was a city at least by the Achaemenid period and probably earlier. The simple explanation is that the exact area of densest settlement shifted around over the millennia. In Susa's case, that means that it's entirely plausible that the Greek version of the city is somewhere underneath modern Shush, and in Ragai's case, that would be underneath of Tehran. Susa itself did see increased activity and much denser activity beginning around this moment in the narrative. More and more commerce occurred in the region, and smaller denominations of coinage, the sorts of little bronze and silver coins that you would use in routine purchases, were both minted locally and brought to Susa from Babylon. This was at least partially due to the Susian market beginning to have more and more access to goods from eastern Iran and India a couple of decades later, but also may have reflected policies instituted by Seleucus II or III that only really came into the archaeological record with Antiochus, such as an increased number of Greek and Macedonian settlers, either culturally or literally arriving in the area. We don't know if they came from elsewhere in Seleucid territory or emigrated from Europe. However, Susiana is not the only name for Elam in this period. There's also Elamites. The last time we heard that word, the Elamites were identified as a group of people in the Elamite highlands or the southern Zagros Mountains who opposed Alexander the Great's advance through their territory. The next time we hear about them, with Antiochus III, the region of Elamites supported Molon. So clearly the meaning of the name in Greek has shifted, but also it's clearly a derivative of the old Akkadian name for Elam. And until the middle of the 2nd century, about 80 years after this episode, Elamites was consistently treated as separate from Susiana. Elamites is generally understood as a part of the Elamite highlands around the borders of modern Khuzestan. But where exactly that meant in this period is very hard to say. It can't have been the entire border of Susiana, because the Seleucids clearly had some control over the passages from Susa to Persis and Media. But regardless, Elamites is generally understood to be a region either just to the north or east of the city, and is generally assumed to be a direct cultural descendant of the Elamite culture, which predates the Achaemenids. Elamian archaeological sites, and the terminology used by the ancient Greeks to describe them, give the impression of continued worship of the old Elamite gods, albeit a version of those gods that had been heavily influenced by the traditional Semitic pantheon of Mesopotamia. To be clear, that was a process of cultural mixing that began over 2,000 years before our current point in the narrative. So seeing it continue in Elamites is hardly a surprise. We have no written records from the Elamians, but given their location and religion, the best guess is that they continued to speak a version of the Elamite language, albeit one heavily influenced by Persian, Aramaic, and other more common regional tongues. We don't really know what the political or social structure of Elamites looked like either, and even guessing would require a better understanding of exactly what segment of old Elamite society survived at this point. They may have been a mixture of long-standing mountain tribes and disparate city-states, or they may have been a cohesive minor kingdom. At the time of Antiochus III, we just don't know. Eventually, we will start to see people identified as the kings of Elamites, but for now, that's a long way off. What we can say is that Elamites was apparently outside the direct control of Antiochus and his satraps, at least in some ways. At this stage, they might have paid some sort of tribute and lip service to the king, but before too long, we will see them come into direct conflict with the Seleucids. And none of the ancient authors treat that as a rebellion. So it seems they were acknowledged to be mostly independent, even under Antiochus's rule. And our next topic, also around the time of Antiochus III, probably helps to explain that. Historians are split on how exactly the peoples of southern Iran reacted when Seleucus II was defeated by Arsaces in Parthia and Diodotus II of Bactria declared himself a king. Some scholars will argue that since we see satraps in southern Iran when Antiochus III was crowned, and no sources directly reference southern revolts in places like Susa, Elamais, and Persis, they must have started out loyal. Others point to the sudden emergence of Elamais as a distinct political force just after Seleucus II's failure to suggest that they too rebelled and seceded from Seleucid control. Personally, that option seems likely to me. But of course, it all gets more interesting when we return to Persis itself. But I wouldn't be running a very good History of Persia podcast if I just jammed the titular province in at the end of an episode. So next time, we will keep Antiochus III on hold while he heads back to Syria, and we explore the history of the Fratarraka. Until then...
If you want more information about this podcast, you can go to hopfulmedia.com. That's where you'll find things like my bibliography, episode imagery, and additional resources. If you want to hear more of my voice, you can listen to America Secret Wars, where I tell my friends and guests the story of forgotten and overlooked conflicts in American history. And if you want to support my projects, you can go to hopfulmedia.com.co to donate, buy merch, or subscribe to get access to ad-free listening and bonus content. If you don't want to spend money on me, that's absolutely fine. The best ways to support a project like this are to share on social media or leave reviews on your podcast app of choice. So review on Apple, rate on Spotify, and you can find me on Blue Sky at History of Persia and on Instagram at History of Persia Podcast. Until next time, thank you all so much for listening to The History of Persia.